Chapter 4. Calming and Clarifying. Many years ago, I received a telephone call from Bob Stiller, the founder of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, a company well known in New England at the time, and now as Keurig Green Mountain all over the world. I was delighted when he said that my work as a meditation teacher had come to his attention. He told me that he was interested in personal growth and asked how I would feel about teaching mindfulness meditation to him, his family, his employees, and, as a public service of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, the general public in northern Vermont. I was very enthusiastic. The possibility that I could teach meditation in a medium-sized company, with the backing of the CEO and his whole senior management, was just too good to pass up. Soon I began working with the employees at Green Mountain once a week, guiding them in meditation. The same architect who built their roasting plant, which at the time processed 21 million pounds of coffee a year, interviewed me about how to build a meditation room. 2 months later, he had constructed a beautiful little zendo meditation hall, right in the middle of the company's human resources department. We began to offer free retreats to the general public. That's when I started to notice something amusing. For me, coffee is a natural complement to meditation, because it helps to keep you alert. When I think of coffee, I think about how it makes my mind clear. This parallels tea, which was introduced into Japan by Zen monks to help them remain awake during long periods of meditation. However, I've noticed that this is the exact opposite of what most people associate with coffee. The general public thought it humorous, even oxymoronic, that a coffee company provided free meditation for the public. Most people think that coffee makes you anxious and frenetic, while meditation means to relax, calm down, and chill out. They seem like opposites. While concentrating and calming down is certainly a part of meditation, it is only half of the story. The other half of the process is clarifying, that is, observing, analyzing, and deconstructing sensory experience. Clarifying leads to insight. This clarifying aspect of meditation is known technically as vipassana. One way to think about meditation is as a dialectical interplay between a calming, concentrating aspect, samatha, and a clarifying, dissecting aspect, vipassana. For simplicity, I'll just call these two sides of meditation the calming part and the clarifying part. When I tell people that I teach meditation, their usual response is to tell me how much they need to calm down, relax, and let go of stress. Very seldom do they tell me how much they need to gain discrimination power or analyze the sensory components of their experience. Our cultural archetype of what meditation involves is skewed toward the calming side of the picture. The calming side makes sense to the average person. It's a little harder to understand how the clarifying aspect works and why it's also a good thing. So let's discuss the calming aspect a little more, then take a look at the clarifying aspect, and then see how the two might work together. Concentration and calm. To begin with, there is an intimate link between the experience of being highly concentrated and the experience of being calm and reposed. The two experiences go hand in hand. As you get ever more concentrated, your body gets physically relaxed and your emotional turbulence calms down. Mental image activity lessens, and you become aware of a sort of uniform soothing darkness or a pleasant brightness in the mind's eye. Mental talk also dies down, and you begin to experience interludes of mental quiet in your head. Thus, calming effects accompany the concentrated state, and this allows us to establish a kind of positive feedback loop between deepening calm and strengthening concentration. The more concentrated we become, the more we experience physical and mental calming. Then, the more we focus on those pleasant calming effects, the further concentrated we get. As we go deeper, the pleasure of the calming effects gets more intense, which motivates us to focus even more one-pointedly on that pleasure, which then produces even more calming pleasure, which then motivates us to focus even more intently on that pleasure. It's a spiral that builds on itself, the pleasure of the calm and the one-pointed attention reinforcing each other in a positive feedback loop that takes us deeper and deeper. This feedback loop is the mechanism that facilitates the attainment of special deep states, known technically as absorptions, jhanas. The first time I ever went into a state of dramatically high concentration, was during my first Zen retreat in Japan. The retreat was harsh and rigorous and lasted 1 week. The first sit of the first day was a half hour long, and at the end of it I felt great. On the second sit, my legs started to cause me a little bit of discomfort, but I still felt great. During the third sit, my legs hurt from the beginning to the end of the sit. By the fourth half-hour sit on the first day, I realized I was in big trouble because I was experiencing intense pain. It hurt so much my body was shaking and I was sweating, and that was just on the first day. Because it was a Zen retreat, there was a zero-tolerance policy toward movement. You were not allowed to shift your posture at all during formal meditation periods. By some miracle, I managed to make it through the retreat, and it was totally worth it. During the very last 5 minutes of the last half-hour sit on the final day, the physical discomfort had reached such intense levels that I thought I was going to pass out. My whole body was shaking, and I was on the verge of bursting into tears and sobbing. I didn't want to lose my composure in front of everybody, so I started to scream to myself in my head, "You're not a baby, don't cry! You're not a baby, don't cry!" over and over and over again. It was awful. And then something dramatic happened. I dropped into a stunningly altered state, which I'd never experienced before. I noticed that the pain was exactly the same, but it didn't bother me anymore. It just felt like flowing energy. The voice inside my head totally stopped for the first time in my whole life. I actually observed this shift taking place. First, my mental voice was screaming at the top of its lungs. Then it was just talking in a normal voice. Then it turned into a whisper. Then it turned into a faint little hint. And then there was silence. I had never in my entire life had the experience of inner silence. It was absolutely worth every minute of the pain, because from that time on, I knew what it was like to hear the absence of chatter in my head. Such was my first personal experience of one of the calming effects of concentration. In retrospect, I realized that the pain made me so focused that it put me into an altered state. There was no place else to go. I was focusing on the pain because I couldn't focus on anything else. But that focused one-pointedness produced a delicious, restful condition in my verbal mind. My whole body relaxed, even though I was in great pain. That was very interesting, because it is the opposite of what I would usually do. Pain typically makes us tense up, but I think I relaxed because I was near the fainting point. When you are about to pass out, you get faint. Your mind becomes light, tranquil, diaphanous, and your whole body relaxes. Even though my focus was on the pain itself, it was also able to produce pleasant calming effects on my mind and body. This illustrates the intimate link between concentration strength and its pleasant calming impact on the mind and body. Because of that, you can, in a sense, get something from nothing. Well, maybe you can't really get something from nothing, but you can certainly get something very big from something very small. Here's what I mean. There are subtle, fleeting, restful experiences available to anyone during the day. Physical relaxation, absence of body emotion, a brief pause in mental talk, and the darkness, brightness behind your closed eyes. There are visual, auditory, and somatic restful states that are available once you know what to look for. Most people aren't even aware that these states are happening. But if you use them as an object of concentration, then the small pleasure they produce becomes more pronounced, more pleasant. When you then concentrate even more, they become more pronounced, creating a feedback cycle. Through concentration, you magnify those tiny, subtle, pleasant experiences into something that is hugely enjoyable and available to you anytime you want. It's not exactly getting something from nothing, but it's getting quite a lot from a very little. I call this approach focus on rest. You let your attention move between visual rest, darkness, brightness, behind your closed eyes or defocused external gaze, auditory rest, mental quiet or physical silence, and somatic rest, physical relaxation and emotional tranquility. Getting caught in a good place. Because there is this intimate link between the pleasure of tranquility and the ability to concentrate, It's natural for people to look upon tranquility and concentration as an end in and of itself. The ultimate goal of such a path would be to have the deepest possible concentration and the greatest possible tranquility pleasure. This sort of ecstatic bliss out is our cultural archetype of meditation. There is a potential problem with that. It's a pitfall of the concentration path, which doesn't happen to everyone, but is nevertheless pretty common. I see it often in my role as a teacher. Let's say a person has been meditating for some time on a simple object of concentration, such as the breath. When they meditate, they get very relaxed and calm. Time passes quickly, and they feel pretty good. Their meditation practice has given them a little edge on life, and that's great. The problem is that in some cases, year after year after year, there may not be dramatic growth beyond that point. Their meditation practice is pleasant and useful, but it's not delivering the life-changing results they should expect. This situation is a specific example of a general phenomenon I call getting caught in a good place. There are two main traps that prevent people from reaching their fullest potential on the meditative path. The first is mistaking the map for the journey. Thinking about and debating about the paths becomes a substitute for systematically practicing a path. The second common trap is getting caught in a good place. The path leads to something good, but growth slows after that. One of the main jobs of a teacher is to make sure that doesn't happen. Tranquility that fails to mature into insight is a classic example of getting caught in a good place. The problem lies in an overemphasis on the calming aspect, without enough of the clarifying aspect, leading to lopsided practice. The person is in a good holding pattern, but doesn't make dramatic strides over the years. Their growth is linear, not exponential. When I encounter this in a student, I tell them that there's good news and bad news. The good news is that they're going into deep states. The bad news is that they are not bringing enough sensory clarity into that experience to foster dramatic growth. When I show them how to do that, it changes everything. It kickstarts their personal growth again, and their meditation practice vastly deepens. The Buddha's discovery of Vipassana. The Buddha was not some sort of god or myth. He was an actual historical person named Siddhartha Gautama. He was a prince, the son of the king of the Shakya nation, which was located in modern-day Nepal. If we strip away the mythology around this person, we can get a pretty clear sense of what he was like as a flesh-and-blood human being. In my opinion, he was one of the most remarkable human beings of all time. Even though Siddhartha Gautama lived about 2,500 years ago, he was essentially a modern person in many ways. He was a rationalist, he downplayed the role of authority, and he was critical of the inequities of the caste system as it existed then. He was the only religious leader in the history of the world who asked people not to follow his teachings based on his authority. That's a quite modern, egalitarian, and refreshing point of view. These things about the Buddha are quite impressive. But I think his most important contribution is that he was the first person in history to clearly articulate a new facet of meditation. Because there is this feedback link between calming and concentrating. People had had a tendency to look upon calm concentration as the be-all and end-all. They believed that the goal of the path was to get greater and greater concentration and go deeper and deeper into pleasant, absorbed states. But according to the traditional accounts, the Buddha discovered an entirely new attentional skill. He found that you could use it to get deep insights into yourself, even the profoundest insights of enlightenment. He discovered how to develop a sort of internal microscope to carefully observe the nature of your own sensory experience. This discovery brought a whole new dimension to meditation, the dimension of clarifying and untangling. Clarifying and untangling fosters insight into fundamental issues, the nature of self, the nature of suffering, the nature of oneness, perhaps even the nature of nature. Here is the traditional story of how he discovered this new way to focus. Siddhartha Gautama was born into a royal family about 500 years before the birth of Christ. A court astrologer said that Siddhartha would either be a world-conquering emperor or a world-changing guru. His father, being a king, did everything in his power to encourage Siddhartha to become an emperor. But the young prince saw how much suffering there was in the world, He also encountered shramanas, people who had shaved heads, wore special clothes, and did not engage in societal activities, but rather pursued, among other things, concentration-style meditation and ascetic practices. He was very struck by the idea of becoming a shramana and overcoming suffering. One night, he snuck out of his father's palace with the goal of seeking a meditation teacher. As I mentioned, concentration practices are found in all cultures, and there were such teachers available to young Siddhartha. His first teacher, Arada Kalama, taught him how to enter a very deep state of absorption and rapture. Siddhartha was something of a spiritual prodigy. He had an enormous natural aptitude for meditation. He was to meditation techniques what Mozart was to music, Bobby Fischer was to chess, or Muhammad Ali was to boxing. Techniques that ordinarily take years or decades to master, Siddhartha was able to perfect in a few months. After he mastered the deepest, most absorbed, blissful, and concentrated state that his teacher knew of, Arada Kalama offered to make Siddhartha a co-teacher. As I mentioned, part of the greatness of the Buddha was that he was very critically minded. He realized that, although there was no suffering in that deep, absorbed state, it returned when he came out of that state. When he was walking around in ordinary life, he could discern that the seeds of suffering were still there. His deep concentration was ecstatic, but it hadn't yet engendered a fundamental shift in his being. To his great credit, Siddhartha recognized this problem. He had achieved something amazing, something that felt incredibly good. His teacher even told him that he had, in effect, achieved all there was to achieve. But Siddhartha wouldn't let himself get caught in a good place. So he sought out another teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta, who knew about even deeper states of absorption. Again, Siddhartha was able to master this new teacher's techniques very quickly. Uddaka Ramaputta declared that Siddhartha had achieved all there was to achieve and offered him a co-teacher position. Even though the new state of absorption he had learned was even deeper than the first, Siddhartha realized that it still hadn't radically transformed his everyday self. There were no other teachers available who could show him any deeper concentration state. So Siddhartha took up ascetic practices, doing extreme self-mortification, starving himself, and so forth. He did this for several years. Eventually, he had the courage to abandon that, too. It was destroying his physical body, ruining his health, and he still felt that he hadn't achieved a fundamental change in his relationship to suffering. At this point, he felt that, although he had learned some important things, he had failed in his quest. So he sat down under a tree and vowed not to get up until he succeeded in finding what he was looking for. And he found it. What had he discovered? According to the traditional story, he discovered a completely new paradigm for the meditative endeavor. He realized that the cultivation of concentration and calm was not an end in and of itself. He discovered how to microscopically investigate in real time the nature of sensory experience, how to break the complex experience of self into manageable sensory elements. This led to an understanding that would permanently uproot the source of suffering, not merely suspend it due to an altered state. After that, people referred to him as a Buddha, which means an awakened person. I call this microscopic investigation of sensory experience sensory clarity. It is the essence of mindfulness meditation, and an extremely powerful method of self-transformation. Analyzing sensory experience. The clarification, insight side of meditation involves analyzing sensory experience into components, and then tracking how those components interact. For example, if you're going through an emotional experience and want to practice meditation, you could decide to use a clarification meditation, moment by moment, analyze your emotional experience in terms of basic sensory elements and their interactions. Let me make that tangible. At any given instant, you may have emotional type sensation in your body, or you may not. By emotional type body sensations, I mean things like teary sadness in the eyes, tense anger in the jaw, queasy fear in the belly, pleasant smile on the face, enthusiastic interest over the whole body, and so forth. These kinds of body sensations are important components of any emotional experience. Mental images are a second component. You mentally see the scene, the people, the situation. You get a mental picture of what your body looks like, and you get mental pictures of the scene around you. You relive the past or fantasize about the future. All involve mental images. So image activity is also an important component in an experience of emotion. And in your head, you hear yourself, or perhaps others, speak. You rehearse what you're going to say, or brood on what was said. You have judgments and rationalizations, and they come up in internal conversation. I call such thoughts talk activity. The three basic components of any emotional experience, then, are mental imagery, mental talk, and emotional-type body sensations. In order to have a quick way to describe things, I often refer to mental images as see-in, mental talk as hear-in, and emotional-type body sensations as feel-in. So if you're going through an emotional experience, you could deconstruct it into three components: mental images, mental talk, and emotional body sensation. But what about when you're not going through anything specifically emotional? Do these three categories still arise? Absolutely. That's the beauty of the whole thing. Any perception of self involves one or a combination of those components. The ancient Greeks said, "Know thyself." But in fact, self-knowledge has many levels. You can know yourself in terms of your personal patterns. That's a good thing. But you can also know yourself as an inner sensory system. That's also good. At any given instant, you either have mental images or you don't. Two possibilities. At that same instant, for each of those two possibilities, you have two further possibilities. You either have mental talk or you don't. Do the math. We now have 4, 2 times 2 equals 4, logical possibilities for any given instant. But at the same instant, for each of those 4 possibilities, you either have body emotion or you don't, which multiplies the possibilities again by 2, yielding a grand total of 8, 4 times 2 equals 8, basic states. 3 possible single occurrences, mental image, mental talk, body emotion. 3 possible paired occurrences, any 2 at the same time. And 2 possible extreme situations. All 3 inner components are active at the same time, or all 3 inner components are inactive at the same time. Thus, we can analyze any subjective state into 8 basic compositional patterns. This represents a somewhat oversimplified view, because each of the inner components can activate over a continuum that ranges from absolute rest to maximum possible intensity. But for simplicity's sake, we can represent them using a binary approximation involving on versus off. Normally, we're preoccupied with the content of our subjective experience, which, of course, can be enormously complex. But the basic composition is remarkably simple if we model it as 3 binary variables producing a total of 8, 2 to the third, basic states. Let's list those 8 possibilities. 3 single occurrences. 1. Mental image only. 2. Mental talk only. 3. Body emotion only. 3 paired occurrences. 4. Mental image and mental talk. 5. Mental image and body emotion. 6. Mental talk and body emotion. 2 extremes. 7. All 3 active at the same time. 8. All 3 restful at the same time. If you monitor your inner experience, memory, plan, fantasy, worry, will, desire, problem solving, judgment, conviction, confusion, and so on, in terms of the 8 basic states, you'll notice something remarkable. When all 3 elements activate strongly, the perception, "I am a separate thing," is very intense. But if only 1 or 2 activate mildly, the perception, "I am a separate thing," becomes somewhat reduced. And most amazingly of all, every once in a while, the inner system spontaneously goes offline, causing your sense of a separate self to vanish. Something that fluctuates with time is a wave, not a thing. And something that vanishes and reappears cannot be thought of as an abiding entity. If there's anything that abides, it is the nothing from which sensory phenomena arise and to which they return. I will say more about this in Chapter 9. Initially, keeping track of those 8 states may be fairly complicated. It may agitate you. It may not feel deep like meditation is supposed to feel, and it may take a lot of effort. So you might legitimately wonder, why bother? Why not focus on pleasant restful states, or something simple like the breath, Well, there is an important and powerful payoff to the clarification side of meditation. The payoff is that it leads to insights, aha experiences. Some of these insights are trivial. For example, you might discover that every time you sneeze, you notice that a certain muscle in your back spasms. You didn't know that before, but you realized it because you were paying such close attention to sensory experience. Such an insight is extremely insignificant, but other insights can be quite profound, such as understanding the difference between pain and suffering, or realizing that you are not separate from the rest of the world, or that the thing you think of as you isn't what it appears to be. Such insights are staggeringly profound and permanently change your experience of your life. A humble metaphor for how the clarifying aspect of meditation works comes from the realm of the office cubicle. Imagine you have a desk, and it is piled high with papers. Not only do you have a tremendous amount of work to do, but the system is also in total disorganization. It's just a blizzard of paperwork, and you don't know what goes with what. A powerful way to deal with this situation is to make some categories for the papers. For example, you might sort them into incoming, outgoing, payables, and receivables. You would create a basket for each category and put the appropriate label on each container. Then you would sort the papers one by one, putting each into its proper basket. You would have analyzed the pile of paper into its constituent components. Not only is your desk now cleaned up and organized, you are now able to get some work done. You may even generate some insight through doing this analytical process. For example, if through the act of sorting you realize that the basket of payables is much fuller than the basket of receivables, you may have to look into your business model. You have gotten insight into your business's income stream. The reason this metaphor seems so obvious is that we constantly do this kind of sorting or analysis in our external world. Categorizing and labeling are a mundane and extremely useful part of our everyday lives. Nothing could run without our doing so. However, practically no one makes use of this powerful technique for cleaning up their inner world. I sometimes call this clarification aspect the divide-and-conquer strategy of Vipassana. Ancient Romans used the phrase divide et impera to describe their strategy of breaking up a conglomeration of enemy forces into smaller units that could be defeated individually. If you will excuse my use of a martial metaphor in this context, I feel that this phrase neatly describes, in a nutshell, how Vipassana works. Breaking a complex experience down into its components makes it easier to understand, thus giving us insight. It also divides up a difficult experience into smaller, less individually challenging pieces, and this makes it easier to cope with. This ability to make life experience both insightful and manageable is the sort of conquering that Vipassana affords us. What gets conquered is suffering, and the distorted behavior that comes from suffering. If divide and conquer sounds too imperialistic and violent, an alternative description of the same thing is untangle and be free. Personally, I like the phrase divide and conquer because scientists and computer programmers use it. Although there is some disagreement among modern scholars regarding this point, according to the traditional narrative, the Buddha discovered a new way to meditate that involved clarifying and untangling sensory experience. States of calm and concentration were systematically cultivated in India before the Buddha's time. Also, asceticism was widely practiced prior to the Buddha's innovations. The original idea in asceticism was that the more you can be patient with pain, the deeper will be the purification of your soul. The Buddha tried such ascetical practices, but eventually abandoned asceticism for a related, but broader, deeper, and more refined paradigm, equanimity. The more equanimity you bring to pain or pleasure, the more it purifies consciousness. In this context, equanimity refers to a relationship to sensory experience, the letting go of craving and aversion around each experience, the ability to allow any and all experiences to expand and contract without interfering. So in terms of meditation strategies, the Buddha made two huge original discoveries: the liberating power of sensory clarity and the purifying power of equanimity. Samatha and Vipassana. As we have seen, the notions of concentration and calm have a natural relationship. It would be useful to have a single word that refers to calm and concentration as an integrated endeavor. In Buddhism, There is just such a word, samatha in Pali, or shamatha in Sanskrit. When we look at how the word is translated into Tibetan, it is very revealing. The Tibetan translation is shine. Shi means calm, and ne means abiding. The ne, or abiding part, could be interpreted as the ability to hold on to, or to concentrate, and the calming or tranquilizing part is the shi. In Pali, samatha combines the notions of both high concentration and blissful calm in a single word. By way of contrast, there is a word vipassana in Pali, vipassana in Sanskrit, that refers to the clarifying side of meditation. Vipassana is a rich term, which combines three related notions in a single word. Passana literally means to see. The prefix vi means two things, apart and through. First, then, vipassana means to break things apart or separate them into their components or particles. This is the analytical or seeing apart aspect. Second, vipassana means to soak your awareness into these components until you see their deepest nature, which is that they are nothing other than the vibrations of space or waves. This seeing through aspect is sometimes referred to by Burmese sayadaws, vipassana masters, as penetrating each sensory event at the moment it arises. Third, vipassana results in insight, the paradigm shift that occurs when you do enough seeing apart and seeing through. So Buddhism traditionally characterizes meditation in terms of two contrasting but mutually complementary aspects, samatha versus vipassana. But I want to emphasize that this is one of many ways to analyze the endeavor of meditation. It's traditional, and it's good to know about. A related alternative way to think about meditation is in terms of three components: concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. Yet another is to think of it as noticing a kind of primordial perfection that is always there so you don't need to meditate. You still should, though. I'll be talking about those other formulations later on. The Buddhist emphasis on cultivating systematic sensory clarity represents a unique innovation in the history of world spirituality. Because of this, there sometimes can be a prejudice in Buddhism against the calming and relaxing aspect of meditation, technically known as absorptions. Some teachers will dismiss such practices out of hand, saying that absorption practices will never get you anywhere. But that's not really true. There is no real conflict between these two sides of practice, between samatha and vipassana. The two mutually aid and reinforce the other. Most people, however, start out with one side or the other. You can work with the subtle, restful experience of mind-body-self, which is a clever way to meditate. If you go into deep, pleasurable absorptions in meditation, this makes the senses seem porous, light, and open. Doing vipassana on such an attenuated experience leads to insight into impermanence, emptiness, and no self, and it's pleasant to boot. On the other hand, you can work with the activated, solidified experience of mind-body-self. It might seem obvious that you'd want to start out with the attenuated, calm, relaxed, samatha-influenced mind-body-self, but that is not always true. For one, some people are not drawn to doing the pure samatha side of practice. Because of their personality, preferences, experiences, or some other reason, they simply like doing vipassana better. Furthermore, vipassana has the advantage that you can do it under any conditions. Samatha, at least early on, requires that you have a quiet room, time to really relax, aren't under a lot of pressure from life circumstances, and so forth. Vipassana, on the other hand, is rough and ready for anything. You can do vipassana perfectly well at a rock concert or on your drive to work. It doesn't have the hothouse flower quality sometimes associated with the initial practice of samatha. There are advantages to starting with either side of meditation. If you can't get to restful states for some reason, it doesn't matter, because you can sit down just as you are, with things very agitated and very solid, and begin to apply the vipassana side of the practice. Applying vipassana without a preceding attempt to develop samatha is sometimes referred to as dry vipassana. It's not watered with the soft pleasure of calm, but it does get the job done. Most people who are drawn to meditation are first drawn to the samatha side of things. That can be either good or bad, depending on how they're taught. If they are taught skillfully, then the samatha practices can lead to great insight. If, however, they are taught unskillfully, they can develop a kind of agenda or longing for certain desirable states. Then if they can't get to those desirable states, they're very frustrated, and they're constantly comparing. Yesterday I was able to go deep, but today I couldn't get as deep, and so forth. The medicine for that is to remember that the main goal in meditation is not to get to certain good states, but rather to eliminate what gets in the way of those good states. If you do that, those good states will be available anytime you wish. As the result of doing dry vipassana, you can work through the craving, aversion, and unconsciousness that prevents the blissful, restful states. As a result of having teased apart experience and clarified it over time, the blissful, restful, absorbed states will arise automatically for you, because you will have worked through the underlying blockages, or that which prevents those restful states from happening. I'll talk more about working through blockages in Chapter 5. So there is a complementarity between samatha and vipassana. If you do the samatha practice and experience wonderful tranquil states, these represent a porous and attenuated self that can be relatively easily penetrated with vipassana. If you can't get to the restful states, that's okay. You do dry vipassana, and as a result, the blockages get deconstructed into their elements, and they lose their gripping force. After that, you automatically find yourself dropping into pleasant, absorbed samatha states simply because you've worked through the forces that would prevent those states from happening. It's a win-win situation. Samatha helps vipassana, and vipassana helps samatha. If you really understand the complementary relationship between samatha practice and vipassana practice, you realize that, no matter what your situation, there's always something productive you can do.